What's up, everybody? Welcome to the Student Loan Planner Podcast today. It is the Financially Free Friday episode. I have a guest with me today, Jared. He's not a stranger. He's been on the podcast before. He also talks on our Financially Free Physicians podcast as well with Sim. He is part of the Physicians Financial Planning team here at SLP Wealth, and he's one of our student loan consultants on the team. Jared, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Hey, Megan, I am so excited to be back on the podcast today. We have super exciting updates in store with Parent Plus loans and Social Security. And I just could not be more excited to nerd out over some Social Security stuff with you, Megan.
Yes, man, I can always count on Jared to nerd out with me about some of the kind of dry stuff, the bone dry stuff. But today it's important to really chat about Parent Plus loans for a couple different reasons and their impact on future financial planning. So if you're somebody who has Parent Plus loans, this conversation is going to be important to you. If you're someone who's in the process of borrowing Parent Plus loans or will be borrowing Parent Plus loans for your kids in the future, this is something that could be important to you. If you are a child of a parent who has Parent Plus loans from your schooling, this could be important to listen through. So Parent Plus loans, just real quick, they are federal student loans that you can borrow under the name of a parent for a undergraduate education. These are getting more and more more and more of the conversation when it comes to school and paying for school, because the cost of attendance with undergraduate degrees has gone up and up and up. However, how much you can borrow as the student has not gone up since, I think it was like 2012 or 2014. It has not gone up since then. So as the student for an undergraduate education, you can only borrow up to $5,500 for your freshman year, $6,500 for sophomore, and $7,500 for junior, senior. So Parent Plus loans have become an increasingly larger part of the picture when it comes to going to school if we don't have the funds to be cash flowing that schooling education or that schooling experience. Uh-huh. And so we're seeing more and more parents of kids who have been to school or who are going to school looking into Parent Plus loans, comparing them to private loans. You know, we've got some stats. We'll talk about those here in a bit. But this is why this conversation is important, because Parent Plus loans are touching a lot of people, and they are for parents, which means we're in a later demographic and we're closer to retirement, and it's going to be affecting retirement in a number of different ways. And this is not something to scare anybody, but something to just be aware of and plan for. We'll talk about a lot of different things that we could be thinking about when it comes to, you know, if you have Parent Plus loans or if you're going to be borrowing Parent Plus loans or if you're helping your parents pay Parent Plus loans. This will be an important conversation. And timing-wise, this is important as well, because an opportunity to get access to cheaper repayment plans ends July 2025. And this is pretty much the last month, January coming up, that we can use to utilize that process, to start the process to get access to those cheaper plans. So that was a long-winded entry, but does that sum Parent Plus loans up really quick? Pretty good.
Megan, this is so important. And the prevalence of Parent Plus loans, as you mentioned, is really, really ramping up. And it's so important for these folks that it coincides a lot with ramping up for retirement at the same time that you're taking out these relatively large loans for your children's school. And that could be a scary on-ramp to retirement to accrue $100,000 plus of Parent Plus debt. This double consolidation loophole and the opportunity to access these other repayment plans can transform the conversation from these Parent Plus loans are a huge burden and really going to interrupt my retirement, to these income-driven repayment plans will keep it kind of a side problem. It's a lower expense on a monthly basis, and I can incorporate this into my plan, and it's not going to deeply interrupt my retirement plans. Mm-hmm. We'll be talking about all of the repayment options for Parent Plus, including what's going to be available to everyone even after June 2025. And of course, we can always build it into the plan. some really great options are going to be off the table after this double consolidation opportunity closes. Mm-hmm. This is really timely that we're talking about this.
Yes. Some quick stats with Parent PLUS loans. We've said that they've been increasing, kind of corresponding with the cost of attendance increasing. This is some data from 2015. We had about $65.1 billion outstanding of Parent PLUS loans at that time. Since then, so this is a couple years old still, but this data is from Q3 of 2022. The outstanding Parent PLUS loan debt stands at $106.3 billion. So it went from 65.1 to 106.3 from 2015 to 2022. So that's about a 63% increase. And I know that this past year, it's probably continued that trend with going up year over year. Total of Parent PLUS loan borrowers, just like how many people have been borrowing Parent PLUS loans, that has also increased. These loans are offered either as part of the financial aid package where, let's say, your kid is going to undergrad, the total cost of attendance is going to be, you know, $40,000. The child can only borrow $5,500. We don't have 529 money or savings set aside to pay for this cost of attendance, but you know, this is the plan for our kid. They need to be going to school. They want to be a doctor. They have to get their undergrad first. $40,000 is the total cost of attendance. We can only borrow up to $5,500 under the student's name. So the difference is what we need to take care of. And so the school will give you two options. They'll say, okay, well, we have Parent PLUS loans that you can borrow, or you can look at private student loans. And a lot of times they'll list like a lender that either not that they're affiliated with, but like a popular lender that you can look at for private loans. And then for Parent PLUS loans, they'll list the federal website where you can fill out the promissory note to go ahead and apply for a Parent PLUS loan, which for the most part, Parent PLUS loans are easier to access than private loans because they're not doing a credit check. Let me back up. They are doing a credit check, right? Yeah. But not the normal credit check that you would think. Like private student loans, they're going to look at your credit score, your income. They're going to go through this whole underwriting process. And Parent PLUS loans, that's not totally the process. What they look at is just, do you have any really negative things on your credit profile? Like, are you in bankruptcy? Have you ever filed for bankruptcy? Do you have any federal debt outstanding or delinquent, I should say? And that's what they're really concerned about, not necessarily the credit score. So somebody with really poor credit could borrow a Parent PLUS loan as long as those other really negative things weren't at play. Right. So a lot more accessible than private loans, right?
Yeah. And a lot of people do end up prioritizing the federal Parent PLUS loans over private for a handful of reasons. One is interest rates are pretty high right now on private student loans. Mm-hmm. The federal Parent PLUS loan is a fixed rate. It's like, are you approved or are you not? And whether your credit score is 500 or 800, you're locked into this 8 or 9% fixed rate that's determined by when you borrow. So for parents that have lower credit scores or poor credit history, but still no defaults, no bankruptcy, and can get approved, the interest rate discrepancy could be enormous. You know, 8 or 9% on the federal Parent PLUS loan, I wouldn't be surprised to see 12 and 13% on a private student loan if your credit score is not too strong right now.
Yeah, or higher. I mean, it's very common. And then a lot of times if it's a private loan, you're borrowing in conjunction with the student. So it's both of you guys are co-signers on the loan. Whereas if it's a Parent PLUS loan, it's just under the name of the parent and it stays under the name of the parent unless you were to go and refinance it later. So a couple different facts there, but that's why we see a lot more federal loans more commonly than private loans. And I'm not upset about it. I think we have way more options with federal Parent PLUS loans than we do with private, especially if we have multiple kids where we're probably going to be borrowing quite a bit. Federal loans give us a lot more flexibility with the payment options that we have because at least we will have one repayment plan based on income. And if we use this double consolidation trick, we may have a couple more options that are based on income. So double consolidation, we've said this term a couple different times, and you may have heard about it, may have come up in your Google searches in the past. You might be actively pursuing it or wanting to pursue it. What the double consolidation is it's essentially a loophole in the student loan system that allows access to income-driven repayment plans that we otherwise would not have access to, because the statute, how it was written for Parent PLUS loans, we only have access to amortized options for if they stay as is, they stay as the Parent PLUS loans. So we can pay principal and interest off in 10 years, could go all the way out to 30 years, depending on the balance, on either a fixed or a graduated repayment schedule. So that's if we left as is. And a lot of times that doesn't bring a lot of relief if our income is low in comparison to our balance, because it's not based on income at all. It's just based on what it would take to pay off the principal and interest. A lot of folks will then turn to, well, what about income-driven options? And naturally, the only income-driven option that Parent PLUS loans were supposed to have access to is a plan called Income Contingent Repayment. That repayment plan is based on 20% of discretionary income. You know, that's an option. 20% could sometimes be better than like a fixed repayment option, but it is still higher. It's a bigger chunk of your income. And so that could be like where folks are concerned going into retirement, thinking like, that might be a lot of my retirement paycheck, which is fair. But so enter in this double consolidation situation. So the statute says if we consolidate Parent PLUS loans, then we only have access to income contingent repayment for an income-driven repayment option. The double consolidation is a series of consolidations to kind of trick the system into thinking that we didn't actually consolidate Parent PLUS loans. And how that works in a nutshell is we've got probably multiple Parent PLUS loans. We consolidate, let's say we take half of our Parent PLUS loans and we consolidate them by themselves. And then we take the other half and we consolidate them by themselves elsewhere. We take them to a different federal student loan servicer so they're not commingled. So then what we have is two direct consolidation loans that did consolidate Parent PLUS loans, so they only have access to ICR, right? Mm-hmm. Well, the magic is in the next step, where we then consolidate the two consolidations together, which at that point, the language is important here. We didn't consolidate Parent PLUS loans, right? In that sequence, we consolidated two consolidation loans. And so the system kind of, it gets around the fact that we, you know, only have access to ICR, because then we've consolidated two consolidation loans. We have access to a plan called income-based repayment, which could be either the new or the old income-based repayment calculation, which is either 10 or 15% of discretionary income, which is lots better than 20%, right?
Yeah, huge difference in the repayment options that are available to you afterwards. And Megan is really the expert in this double consolidation strategy. We have lots of resources on our website to help you along this process. Megan, is this administratively pretty simple, or does it take a little while?
I wish it was administratively simple, but no. We've done, as a company, hundreds, if not thousands at this point, of double consolidation processes. We've got the process down and we've got kind of the flow down of what should happen, but we're always running up against, you know, the servicer's timing for consolidations, because consolidating is not fast. It takes, they say, 30 to 90 days, and it can take all the way up to that 90-day time frame to get one consolidation done. So it's not a quick process a lot of times, especially if there's a bunch of drama going on in the student loan system, right? like there is now.
That's like always the case, just
yeah.
at least in the last 2 years. Yeah.
So that's one problem with it, is it's not fast. And we do run into issues a lot of times where, you know, not necessarily on the first, well, actually, you can run into problems on each step. And it's knowing about what problems could come up and how we can pivot or fix those problems. That's what's important. That's what we've gained a lot of experience in over the years, is like knowing what to expect or knowing how to pivot if we've hit some kind of roadblock or weird situation. Like we've run into a lot of those weird situations already doing this process as much as we have. So the process itself is not straightforward. It takes time. It's also tedious in the sense of there's paperwork involved. It's not a bunch of online applications. There's maybe one online process, but we can only do one online consolidation every 6 months. So we use paper applications to still move forward with consolidating, because we don't want to wait 6 months in between processes. And we don't have to if we do a paper application. It's just, we're kind of running up against also how the system works, how their process was set up, because this is not a normal process. It's a loophole in its essence. So of course, it's not going to be something that even they're going to walk you through, because it's not something that's part of their normal practice, right? That is what we're looking at. So the double consolidation process, it definitely gets access to those cheaper income-driven plans, which can be really, really helpful when it comes to managing payments in retirement. It's difficult to do. You know, we've got lots of resources on our website for how you can do it on your own. We've got a YouTube video of me showing you how to do it, a blog. And then we have one-on-one help that you can hire us for to help with both like the plan and the process, two separate meetings there. It's involved, but it's worth it if we could get access to those cheaper plans. But what's the deadline coming up, Jared? Tell us about what's coming up.
Yeah, so the statute that was kind of baked into a long document that was released when the SAVE plan was announced, that effectively the Department of Education knows about this loophole. Yeah. And they've put
it's not a secret.
Yeah, it's not a secret. They've seen thousands and thousands of people successfully execute this plan. And so they put language into a recent update that June 30th, 2025 will be the last day that that final consolidation can be processed in order to benefit from this loophole, right? So starting July 1st of 2025, that might sound far off, but it's really not. It's less than 6 months away. Starting July 1st, that consolidating two consolidation loans that contained Parent PLUS loans previously will be treated as a Parent PLUS loan, as far as we know right now. The deadline is coming up here, halfway through 2025, to get access to these additional income-driven repayment plans. That can really make a big difference in your cash flow in retirement. Not just in retirement, but after your children are done with school and your Parent PLUS loans come out of deferment, after that, you get a bill in the mail that if you don't elect any repayment plan, it's going to be a 10-year amortization, the standard 10-year plan. And on a $100,000 loan balance, which is from the loans that we see, that's actually a modest amount, that's about $1,100, $1,200 a month right off the bat that you're expected to pay back. And with the double consolidation, getting on income-based repayment or, you know, some of the other repayment plans that that unlocks, it really depends on what your income is what your monthly payment is. But we see people all the time that have $200, $300, $600 monthly payments. Even when they're working full-time, their income doesn't generate a payment over $1,000. There's a big spectrum. And there are some folks that do the math and they're like, well, my payment would be higher on IBR. Why would I go through this heartache to do all the paperwork? And it's like, well, your income is not going to be where it's at right now for the next 25 years. If you're in your 50s and you think 10 years later, 15 years later, you might reduce your hours, you might stop working, you might start pulling from investments or Social Security and other places. So even for folks who this doesn't drive a lower payment right now, it can still open more options, more doorways for you in the future. Mm-hmm.
I think that's a good point because it's about also locking in options. And I love options when it comes to planning because who knows what the heck is going to happen in the future? Who knows what your income is going to be or how long you're going to want to work for? If we have availability of options, even if we don't need those other options, like that still, as a planner, makes me feel a lot better, right? Uh-huh. Probably you too, Jared.
Yep, definitely. One thing I say to my clients all the time, there's two statements that I always make. One is, we make the best decisions we can with the information we have today. Mm-hmm. And I want to leave as many doors open and avoid closing doors in the future. And this is really a perfect example of that. There are some folks that would really benefit from doing a double consolidation, even if you're not going to benefit from those new repayment options for 5, 10, 15 years.
Yeah, I think that's what's key is like folks who probably need to entertain this process would be those that are going to be borrowing a balance that is close to their income, or definitely folks that have a balance a lot greater than their income, or the balance will be greater than their income in retirement, and they're concerned about flexibility in the payments in retirement. So that's who this double consolidation process could be really ideal for. And also for those who are going towards public service loan forgiveness, let's say you are a school teacher and you intentionally borrowed these Parent Plus loans because you knew that you'd be working in public service for longer and you're pursuing PSLF with the Parent Plus loans. We need to be on an income-driven plan to be eligible for PSLF, and the double consolidation can make that even cheaper for you to get to PSLF as soon as cheap as possible. And so kind of the same rules apply, like when we're talking to a regular borrower about what should we be doing? Should we be going towards loan forgiveness or should we be paying the loans off? Same kind of rules apply where we need to look at where your balance is in comparison to your income. And then especially for our Parent Plus folks, like where's your income going to be in the future? Because unlike maybe our graduate students going through this process of figuring out where to go, like forgiveness or payback, like their income is going to be going up over time, likely, right? Because they're starting at the very beginning of their career. As a Parent Plus borrower, that's going to be the opposite for you probably, right? You're going to be starting at a higher place, like with your active income while you're still working, and you may see your income go down over time because you're in retirement, you have different sources of income or lower sources of income in those retirement years. Or it's just taxed differently, right? Your income might be taxed differently in retirement. So that's what we got to think about for future planning. And this is why this is part of our Friday episode, because it's definitely a student loan conversation, but it's also a retirement conversation for these Parent Plus people, because it's not thinking about like just the payback. And it's never just thinking about the payback of the loans, right? It's thinking about all the other financial pieces, but it's also protecting that retirement for you too, and giving yourself options to make sure that the retirement game plan is going to look as, you know, great as possible with the options that we have available.
And at SLP Wealth, I feel like we're working with a good chunk of folks who we helped with the Parent Plus double consolidation, and now they're getting ready for retirement or they're in retirement and they're seeing some of the benefits of having done that double consolidation. But as you mentioned, Megan, that's really just a piece of their retirement plan. So we're digging into the details of what age do I start claiming Social Security? When can I leave my job or start reducing my hours? What does my income profile look like at the end of retirement? And how do these student loans play into it? Those income-driven repayment plans really, really make a big difference compared to if you were stuck on only an amortized option. We're really working with folks on how all of these pieces go together. It's been really amazing to see what folks are doing with that flexible expense that they've now built with these income-driven repayment plans. Could be the difference between retiring a year or two earlier. So it's been really, really awesome working with Parent Plus borrowers on the other side of the double consolidation.
Yeah. Fun fact, we have a person who's on our team, on our tax team, that we helped with a Parent Plus consultation back in the day. So like some time ago, did a double consolidation with this person, and they are now working on our tax team because by trade, they were a tax professional. And so we started SLP Tax, and they applied immediately thinking like, oh my gosh, this is going to help out the company that really helped me out. And it's really fun having them on our team because they have that unique perspective of being a client, going through a consultation process with us, and then being on the other side of it, like still working, you know, because that was part of their plan. But it's fun to have that.
Absolutely. I think a lot of our colleagues have stories of either they were clients or like podcast listeners. We were fans before we were working here, because we're just fans of the great work and that Student Loan Planner has done. And so excited to be on the SLP Wealth team. And the tax manager you're speaking of is an awesome, awesome addition to our tax team. He's a great team player. And it's really so cool. We genuinely use financial planning to change people's lives. I don't think that's an overstatement. We've seen it. We've felt it. We've gotten the email that it's like, you helped me navigate PSLF, and now I have a $250,000 loan balance forgiven. It's like, yeah, cool. I can sleep well tonight. It was great.
Right. Right. That is a great feeling. I tell folks all the time, like, email me like your good news with your student loan stuff or with your finance stuff. Like it makes our day to hear about like y'all's wins.
Yeah.
But with that said, going into planning, Jared is always somebody who I run to when I've got some complicated questions when it comes to planning in general. Like probably any question I feel like that I was stumped by, I'll put into our planner Slack channel. And Jared always has some kind of good insight into like, oh, well, I think this is the case. Here's a source that you can check me on, or, you know, I think this is how it's going to look. So you're always really great about helping even the planners on the team learn new stuff and look at things a little differently when it comes to some unique scenarios. But
yeah,
that's why I'm excited to talk about Social Security with you, because Social Security is complicated. And then some of the things that go into like retirement planning and retirement income can get kind of tricky. And if we're talking with Parent PLUS loan borrowers about like what their income may look like in retirement and how that's going to affect their student loan payment, because either way, we do the double consolidation or not, we'll have access to these income-driven options, you know, either the 10, 15% option or the 20% option with ICR. So income is still a really important component to our financial plan for Parent PLUS borrowers. So give us a quick overview, if you could, of, actually, I have a joke for you.
All right.
About Social Security.
Hit me with it.
Are you ready?
Yep.
So I have a joke for you about Social Security. Never mind. You're probably not going to get it. That was really bad, probably. Oh, man.
We'll do a separate podcast on the solvency of Social Security.
I'm just kidding. That's a horrible joke, but
I get that question all the time. If I'm working with a couple in their 30s or an individual in their 40s, and they're like, why are we incorporating Social Security into my plan? Should I even count on it? And my general rule of thumb is like, yeah, it'll probably be there, but you know, maybe not at the same rate it is today. If you're in your 50s and 60s and it's right around the corner, I wouldn't worry about it so much. My goal here is to take a really dry subject and make it somewhat entertaining and useful.
I believe in you.
Do you remember, this was probably like, we're millennials. Do you remember the like pixie dust candy in elementary school that was like powder and you'd have a sugar stick? I don't know why they gave that to children.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was so dry. So that's Social Security. And I'm trying to make it into like a pixie stick with a little bit more fun today.
Nice.
So a little throwback there. It is super important, and a lot of the planning that we do around double consolidation for our Parent PLUS borrowers depends upon what your AGI, your adjusted gross income, is going to be in the future. We do some estimates to project that out, and we'll ask you in our student loan consultations, what's your income look like now while you're working? What are your thoughts on when you'd like to reduce or stop working? And a really broad question we'll ask is, what do you expect to earn in retirement? And a lot of folks just haven't thought that far or haven't mapped it out or just aren't quite aware of what their income will look like in retirement. But one thing that's going to be true for pretty much everyone is at some point, Social Security is going to be a piece of that income. A lot of our student loan planning has to do with timing. I've met with folks that are maybe close to PSLF or even close to income-driven forgiveness. Like they have 23 years of credit and they need to finish a 25-year timeline on IBR, mostly because they had some of their own debt and have accrued that credit towards also their Parent PLUS loans. For them, think about it. If I'm 62 years old and I have 2 years left to go on my student loans, and I'm trying to decide whether or not to incorporate Social Security into my income right now and claim that benefit, there's some big timing decisions to be made here, where delaying Social Security could mean that my student loan payment is lower for another 2 years. There is a scenario out there that claiming Social Security doesn't impact your student loan benefits, which is a wild statement, but it's important to understand how Social Security is taxed, because how does the student loan certification look at your income? They look at your tax return most of the time. So if your income was under $32,000 filing jointly, you could have no taxes on your Social Security income. I recognize that that probably means that Social Security is the only source of income or one of the few sources of income.
Yeah. Or you have a ton of like non-taxable income, which, you know, that could be the case if you have a bunch of like Roth money potentially. Maybe you did a bunch of Roth conversions over time. Yeah.
Or some folks stack cash up and just have the money available to themselves for retirement. But it's important to understand how Social Security folds into this and how Medicare premiums folds into your income as well. For most folks, if you're married filing jointly and your total income is over $44,000, 85% of your Social Security benefit is taxable income. And those brackets have not been adjusted for inflation for a long time.
I was going to say, I think they've stayed there for a while. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's actually a similar phenomenon to what's happening with undergrad borrowing. More and more people fall above that income limit because the limits haven't been adjusted. So for most folks, it's going to be 85% of your benefits are taxed. That's a really important decision. When do I claim my Social Security benefits? It's a very complicated subject. We don't have time to fully get into it today.
But yeah, that is the thing, though, with Social Security, planning on it or not. And I think when we do our planning, we do a couple scenarios where we could plan with it in the picture, or we could plan with it out of the picture, or we could plan it looking a little different. We could do some like different number crunching there. But the earliest you can get Social Security or you can claim Social Security is 62 years old. And some folks are still working at 62. So they're not planning on claiming that money until maybe 65, or you could claim it anywhere between 62 and 70 is like the max, where if you wait until 70, the benefit is higher. So it's kind of this gradual increase. Like the longer you wait, the more Social Security is going to be. I think you said it's like about an 8% increase per year. Yep, is that right?
Each year, yeah. The longer you wait, the more the benefit is.
Yep. And you also have what's called a full retirement age, which for folks who are, what generation is that? Generation X boomers, that's 66?
Yeah, there's a range of 66 to 67.
Yeah.
And it goes up by 2 months every 2 years. But for a lot of our folks, it's probably 67 is full retirement age.
Yeah.
And if you are working before you reach your full retirement age, your benefits can actually be reduced. So there's a little bit of an incentive to wait there as well if you need to work during those years as you're waiting for it to build up.
Yeah.
It's very, very unique to each situation.
Yeah. There's like Social Security like planners out there that will they'll run the math and do all the different scenarios with you when that time comes, which can get kind of interesting. But it is, I think with Social Security, it was never meant to be your full retirement income. It was designed to be a supplement. That supplement has gotten, I guess, with inflation and looking at where retirement stands today with folks, like it's gotten to be like a smaller and smaller portion of people's retirement, I guess you could say. But it's also meant to be just this like floor, this floor of your retirement plan where it's just that kind of guaranteed paycheck that you have coming in each month. And what you're saving in your 401k, maybe if you have a pension, or what you're saving in your other investment accounts like IRAs and brokerage accounts, that's what's supposed to stack on top of those kind of guaranteed income streams to get up to the standard of living that you currently live or that you want to be living in retirement. So it's never meant to be the full picture, but it is income. It could be taxable income. For the most part, it's about 85% taxable to the folks that we're talking to when we're working with them on numbers on what that Parent Plus student loan payment could look like. So not horrible. I think 85% is better than 100%, right? Taxable. So I'll take that.
Definitely. There's one other important piece of tax planning that I wanted to incorporate into our conversation today. That is Medicare premiums. Again, could not think of a drier subject, right?
Everybody has it on their paycheck, right? They have taxes going to Medicare. What is that for?
Yeah. And there's a lot of misconceptions about Medicare too. A lot of folks think, oh, once I'm age 65, I don't have to pay for my health insurance. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Not the case. There are premiums involved with it. It's heavily subsidized, mm-hmm. but it's a sliding scale of subsidies made to benefit lower income folks more. And so the way that they measure that is they look at your AGI from 2 years ago to determine what your income was. Mm-hmm. And your Medicare premiums are based off of your prior year's income.
Yeesh. Why is it 2 years? That's what I wonder. Because student loans, it's off of the most recent year.
They did the same thing with the FAFSA for people applying for undergrad.
So you can't hide income is what I think. A lot of folks aren't planning 2 years in advance, or that would be more difficult to do, where like the year before or the year of, then maybe you could be hiding assets, hiding income, you know, for more of a subsidy.
Yeah, I don't know exactly why they did prior year. I think in the past, there's been confusion around like almost the strategy that we use is if I file an extension, like which mm-hmm. year are they going to use? And people were using that strategy. Who knows? Maybe student loans will end up being prior year. We'll see.
Yeah. What kind of, this is kind of a weird comment, but I feel like with Social Security and Medicare and the timing around all of those benefits, those government programs, right? It reminds me a lot of the planning that we do with student loans, like the maneuvering around timing, the income impact of the, like what the premium payment's going to be. Like it reminds me of that. So I'm sure there's been a lot of very strategic planning out there with like Medicare or Social Security, people like us, like consultants, basically.
Right.
Like trying to maximize the benefit as much as possible for people going into retirement, just like we do with student loans. So.
Absolutely.
Makes sense.
Yep. There are definitely specialists that spend all their time on this. Mm-hmm. But I want to point out one pitfall or one like danger that we need to call out and be weary of when we're doing the student loan planning for folks. Mm-hmm. A big strategy that we use is filing taxes separately will allow you to exclude your spouse's income from your student loan calculation. Mm-hmm. We have lots of podcasts and blogs that explain more about that strategy, but it's something that a lot of Parent Plus borrowers are using. Maybe one spouse is still working and the other spouse has the student loans and mm-hmm. you don't want to be paying on the spouse's income. So you file your taxes separately. Mm-hmm. When you file your taxes separately, there's like a baked in penalty to your Medicare payments. Mm-hmm. When you file jointly, there are five different tiers of what your Medicare premiums increase to. Mm-hmm. And that first tier starts around $212,000 of income.
Oh, dang. Okay.
The most expensive tier there costs about an additional $670 a month. Mm-hmm. When you file separately, you go up to the second highest tier almost instantly at $106,000 of income. If you've done the Parent Plus double consolidation, or even if you didn't, and you're filing separately for other reasons, if you earn more than $106,000, there's effectively like an $8,000 penalty for Medicare.
Gotcha. For filing separately.
So, when we do your student loan consultation, we are considering for folks that are of a Medicare age, 65 and older, that filing separately might not be the greatest idea, or at least we have to factor in how much does the student loan payment benefit versus what is the tax penalty when it comes to Medicare, when it comes to the differences in tax brackets if you're in a common law state. And I just wanted to kind of make sure that we talked about that because that's a pretty steep penalty, right? Yeah.
Is that for the household or is that for one person, the 109, I think it was, like if you make over 109?
Yeah. So if you're filing separately as an individual, if your income is more than 106,000, and those are numbers for 2023, they will get inflated a bit each year. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this is just something that we work with our clients on, and mm-hmm. we're aware of these Medicare brackets when it comes to your retirement plan and how it impacts your student loan plan.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. And so with that, because there's always tax implications for filing separately. It's just about how big are those tax implications compared to what the student loan payment would look like if we were filing jointly. So I could see that being kind of an interesting scenario where maybe it doesn't make sense to file separately if your spouse doesn't make that much income. Maybe they're just living off of their own Social Security, or they're just living off of a small pension. That smaller income, while maybe if we didn't have the Medicare penalty, maybe it would have made sense to file separate and take the small penalty from like the tax bracket perspective. But with the Medicare penalty in there, maybe it does shift our gears towards actually filing joint makes more sense. Our payment will be higher, but we won't have to pay as much come tax time. So those are definitely things that we're thinking about, that we're weighing when it comes to crunching those numbers and comparing the costs of filing jointly to separately for student loan purposes, because it touches other things.
Yeah. And that's why we're student loan specialists, right? If everything was in a silo, then filing separately makes sense a lot of the times. But mm-hmm. we're always considering what external factors will help you, will hurt you, and weighing those to make a very informed, holistic decision on what your filing status should be.
Yep. Fair. And you can find these brackets, I think, is that linked down below?
Yeah, ssa.gov. Again, reading through this stuff can be quite dry.
Jared is writing an article on this, though, so that'll be linked in the show notes, and we'll have that on our website, kind of explaining this a little more in detail. But yeah, I think in a nutshell, I think when it comes to Social Security, when it comes to Medicare, when we're talking about planning and income-driven repayment for our retirees who are married, or for folks who will be in retirement with these Parent PLUS loans, there's a couple more considerations we have to take into account when it comes to income and if we're filing married jointly versus married separately. But it's not something to scare us away from these options. Like, I think that's the important takeaway, is that income-driven repayment could still be a really great option to preserve your retirement, and maximizing that plan takes maybe a couple extra steps to just make sure we know if we should be doing joint or separate, and then what are we giving up? What are the benefits? Does it mathematically make sense? This planning is still the same when the double consolidation loophole closes. ICR, income contingent repayment, is still going to be, I think, valuable, because it's still something based on income, which can be better than an amortized payment calculation, especially for those who are working in public service. So if you're listening to this thinking like, well, I'm going to be borrowing, you know, my spouse and I are going to be borrowing in the future for our kids, think about how I would strategically think about that on who should borrow, because it can only be borrowed under one parent. I think you should be thinking about who works in public service, if anybody, and who's going to be staying in public service long-term. So working at a nonprofit or a government entity, that's one consideration, because then you could be looking at pursuing PSLF. And then the second piece to that is, if no one's working in public service, then who's the lower income earning spouse? Because if we're filing separately, it could make sense to be, you know, having the loans under that one parent who's got the lower income, so the payment can be as low as possible. So those are some pre-borrowing thoughts that could be helpful to help you on the back end when it comes to repayment. I went on a little tangent there, but I didn't want folks to be scared of, you know, if the double consolidation closes, like, does any of this matter? And yes, it still does, because we could still do some really good planning with ICR and filing jointly or filing separately. We just have to figure out, like, what are these other implications with Social Security and Medicare and those tax brackets and things like that.
Yep. I think the double consolidation, as we talked about in the beginning, leaves as many doors open as possible, mm-hmm. and it doesn't close any doors to you. Mm-hmm. You know, you'll still have access to that standard 10-year if that's the decision you end up making. You'll still have access to the 30-year graduated. You're not closing doors on yourself by doing the double consolidation. Mm-hmm. You're just opening the opportunity for more repayment plans. And we'll be strategic about how we file our taxes, which parent is borrowing the loans, if you're listening to this beforehand. Mm-hmm. We can really, really make a big impact on the total cost of your kids' education using these income-driven plans. And the double consolidation just magnifies the impact that we can have there.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I think that gives us a good high-level overview of the retirement income implications from, like, government sources, Social Security, Medicare, and just maybe the pros of course, the double consolidation, but also the pros of ICR still being an option, because there will be folks that will only have access to ICR in the future, either because you're still borrowing, like you still have kids in school, so we can't complete the double consolidation by July 2025 coming up, or because we miss it, because it is something that realistically we're relying on these servicers to complete this process in a timely fashion. A lot of that's out of our control. We could do our best to have the paperwork looking perfect, or you could do your best to have the paperwork perfect, everything in order, mailed to the right places, you know, your T's are crossed, your I's are dotted, but it comes down to them and their processing and their communication with you too. Because if there's a problem, you have to fix the problem. And if you're not able to fix it quickly, like there's just a lot of little factors going in. So I think this episode too is meant to be like a, hey, this is kind of last call for this double consolidation process. If you want to go ahead and get started with the loans that you have right now, it's not guaranteed to get done by June 30th, the deadline, but this is our last shot at trying, you know, because the most it can take, I like to tell folks, the shortest it can take and the longest it can take. And I think the shortest it can take, the shortest I've seen it is within 4 months. But that was, you know, not so much recently because processing has been taking a little longer, but shortest it could be done is in 4 months. Longest, I would say use the 30-day longest consolidation period, and everything's going perfect. So let's assume maybe that's 6 months is the longest it can take. So 4 to 6 months is realistically what we're looking at. So the sooner we can get started, the better. We've got a YouTube video instruction on our website. Just Google Student Loan Planner, Parent Plus Loan, and you can find that article and then that YouTube video with the instructions, or schedule a one-on-one consultation with us. We can help one, make sure that that's the game plan. So how that consultation process works with our Parent Plus folks is we have one meeting starting out that we do the plan where we're looking at, you know, does double consolidation even make sense? What are the pros and cons? What income-driven plan or what repayment plan should we be on? What does that look like over time? We're doing some income calculations. We're doing MFS versus MFJ, like calculations as well. So it's really putting together the plan in that first meeting. And then the second meeting, we have a follow-up for our Parent Plus folks that you can schedule. It's optional, where we help with the paperwork itself. So the first meeting designed for getting the plan together, you'll get instructions on how to complete the paperwork and you do it on your own. And the second meeting is meet with the Parent Plus specialist to go through and do the paperwork together. And then they're with you each step of the way to make sure that the process is done as best and as accurately as it possibly can be. So it has the highest success at getting done. So we've got availability. If this is something that you need to get done in January, this is kind of the last month, I would say. I feel comfortable saying like, yeah, I think we've got good chances at getting this done. So if this is something that you need to do or you need to revisit, check out our website, studentloanplanner.com, and there's a place where you could schedule that first meeting with us. Did we leave anything out, Jared?
No, I think this was a really good reminder of the deadline coming up and the power of that double consolidation. And just a few considerations for life after the consolidation.
Yeah, life after consolidation, yeah. Right.
It's definitely so, so valuable for the folks that have the opportunity to do that. And we're here to help you along the way and consider the pros and the cons and the trade-offs and the risks and all of that as you try to plan your life around your finances, or your finances around your life, rather.
Yes.
Is kind of the way. Like to approach it.
Yeah, I think that's how we all like to approach it. Finances around your life. And I think it's cool that we can help you both on the student loan side specifically if you just really need help with the student loans, but we could also help on the financial planning side if you would like to work with us as a ongoing financial planning client to talk through like the other pieces of your finances, not just the student loans, you know. But thanks for joining me today, Jared, and helping with this pretty complicated topic, pretty confusing topic, helping break it down a little bit more for us. And we'll have that article that you're writing available for folks to look at on the website as well for some more context, and check out the double consolidation article and video we've got online as well to continue to just immerse yourself in this topic if this is relevant to you or if it's relevant to your parent, for example. Thanks, Jared.
Thank you so much for having me, Megan. Always love jumping on the podcast with you, and glad that we were able to cover some awesome time-sensitive topics today with Parent Plus borrowers.
And catch Jared on the Financially Free Physicians podcast as well. That's our spinoff channel for physicians specifically. You're on a couple episodes over there so far.
Yeah, we have a ball over there. Megan's like the most fun host, but Sim is second place. Sorry, Sim. We have so much fun on these podcasts.
Yep, Sim is great. And y'all know Sim because I frequently pull her into my Friday episodes.
Yeah.
Well, hope you have a lovely weekend, and we will catch you on the next one. Thanks for joining.
What if you could get fiduciary financial planning specific to your profession that's student loan aware that could change your life for a price much better than you ever dreamed possible? If that sounds good to you, go to slpwealth.com/pod for a free, no obligation, 15-minute intro call with one of our own fiduciary financial planners to see if we could be a good fit for you. This podcast is for informational, educational, and entertainment purposes only and should not be considered individualized investment advice. If a specific investment is mentioned, do not consider it a recommendation to buy or sell the investment. Seek first advice from a financial professional before implementing any strategies discussed. All investments involve risk, and past performance does not guarantee future results. Yay, compliance.